Okay, so if you could talk about the title actually, because I found it a very beautiful title, Evening is the Whole Day. And
Thanks. Yeah. Well, actually, I'd written the whole novel, and I'm not very good at finding titles, so I was sort of scrambling around trying to find a title, and I came across that poem, which is one of the epigraphs, and I really liked the poem, and it sort of seemed to reflect both the mood of the book, but also sort of, you know, how the book plays around with time a bit, and the idea of time being relative and beginnings being endings, and you know, the fact that it moves backwards. So the poem sort of reflected that aspect of the book as well. And I had just gone to that collection of poems, and you know, I just was browsing, actually, just gone back to that to see if I could find a line that sort of spoke to me, hoping to find something that I could use for a title, because I had a ton of titles before that. Like every version, every draft would have a new title, and none of them, I didn't really like any of them, and neither did my agent. And I said, well, let me see if there's something in these poems, and
I was wondering about that
eventually
because
found
I
them.
do that too. I kind of go through all these working titles and I
Right,
don't
yeah.
feel quite right about it. Can you share any of the others that you had before it was Evening is the Whole Day? What were some of the others?
Let me think. There was let I tried things like, you know, quoting lines of dialogue that were
Oh yeah.
in the book. So I think there at some point someone says, "What for all this drama now?" But it
Okay.
just was sort of an awkward and clunky title. And then I think The Big House, but it was just too generic and so too much like so many other. You know, there's so many novels called The Something or Other House.
I mean, what I liked about it was it was not a very literal thing, but it is very, very poetic, and it does give a sense of the book. So good. Now, along with a quote from the poem, you also have one from Graham Swift at the beginning of the book about sort of history beginning when things go wrong, and there's a sort of wistfulness to it, like what if, how, things turned out differently. Could you talk a bit about that and how that sort of ties in with the themes of your book?
Yeah, that too came rather late in the process. I had been working on the book for many years, and then I think about a year or two before I was finally done with it, I happened to read Waterland, which had been on my list for a while, but I'd never got around to it. And then finally, one summer, I picked it up and read it, and just was completely bowled over because it seemed to, I mean, on the surface, it's very different from my novel, but it seemed to be playing with many of the same themes. The idea of, I suppose the central idea being like, you know, in either a personal or a national history, how far back do you have to go to, not to fix things, but to, you know, how far back do you have to go to reach a point where things could have gone differently? So that was,
I think it's a great book to talk about, Evening is the Whole Day, because you don't have to worry about giving away the ending because you give it away
Right, because
yourself.
the ending is at the beginning. Yes, exactly.
So I mean I think that that for me that had a very interesting effect on the way I read the rest of the novel. But could you talk a bit about what you intended by doing that?
Yeah, again, it wasn't something that was there from the beginning. I mean, I sort of played around with so many different structures, and you know, obviously, I started with the sort of the default position, which is to tell the story chronologically, beginning at the beginning and ending at the end. But then I found that I kept sort of doing these flash forwards because I really wanted the reader just to know what was going to happen at the end, so that you know, I really wanted the main question of the novel to be why rather than what. So and so I kept doing these flash forwards, and they felt very heavy-handed because there's really no, I mean, you know, maybe there are a few books out there that pull that off, but it's really very, very difficult to do well, to keep saying what's going to happen. And so I thought, well, if I want them to know what happens at the end, then why don't I just tell them up front and go from there? And so that's what I did. And after doing that, and after, you know, once I started writing it and thinking about it more, then I realized that, yeah, there are, you know, lots of other novels out there that do similar things. But when I came up with it, I did come up with it on my own and thought, well, okay, I'll try this and see, and sort of had to. I mean, I'm not that I'm generally as a writer, I'm not the kind of person who makes outlines or who draws up a plan of the structure before beginning. But at that point in the novel, when I decided that I was going to tell the story backwards, then I did sit down and sort of plan the whole thing out.
Yeah, because it's quite intricate. I mean, I actually went. I when I'd finished the book, I sat down and planned it all out myself to see what you'd done. And it's kind of like you do go backwards in the sort of more current time, and then in the backstory, you're kind of going forwards.
Exactly.
And
Yes,
it sort of.
that's exactly right. And there was a lot more. The first draft before I saw the book had a lot more of the backstory as well. So it really was alternating chapters with one with one storyline moving backwards and the other narrative moving exactly forwards, and they just alternated like that. But then what ended up happening is that I just cut out a lot of the backstory because it wasn't necessary, and sort of weighing the whole thing down. So what you have left is, yeah, what you have left is more or less that backwards story. Yeah.
For me, it gave the book a lot of what happens to the characters a sort of sense of inevitability. You know, like, you know, because you know that what is going to happen to Chelam, she's going to get sort of sacrificed, and it has that sort of sense of inevitability to it. And I wondered if that was something that you wanted, because, you know, because it's kind of the position of the servant in that household. It is kind of inevitable that if something bad happens, she's going to be the one to get sacrificed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't think of it, you know, in you're a writer yourself, so you know when you're writing, you're not really thinking about sort of the, you know, the analysis after the fact or how it's going to come, the theory behind it. It doesn't, you know, I was just sort of telling the story, and it seemed to me to be the best way to tell the story, to get to the order in which I wanted to convey the facts, so to speak. But then you're right that it does, that idea of inevitability was sort of a bonus that came from that structure. And also the other thing that emerged from the structure that I hadn't thought about before was that once you know the ending and you know that it's not a happy ending for anyone, then it's sort of everything that comes after that, even sort of the hopeful moments in the book or the moments that seem like, you know, oh, well, this could lead to something good, you do know that actually it doesn't go anywhere good. So it's, I think it does, it ended up imbuing the whole book with a kind of melancholy that would have been I would have had to do something else to have that if I had been telling the story forwards.
I know what you mean, because otherwise you'd be sort of rooting for them, for it to work out, you know, but then you, with doing it this way, you know that it's not, so it does give it a melancholy, which is set from the very title, which is a kind of melancholy thing. Right. Evening is the whole day for people who've lost their lovers and that sort of thing.
Right.
The book also, it deals with a lot of sort of big political issues, and yet it's sort of very much in the background of the book. I thought it was an interesting way to handle it, that, you know, the book is very much set in the big house and everything happens there, and it's a sort of it's very much self-contained world in many ways, and that the politics are kind of, you know, the race riots of 1969 and those things are, they're referred to in a, you know, but it's always sort of in a background way. I was wondering if you ever toyed with having it play more of an overt role in the plot, or did you always want it to be a kind of background?
No, not really, actually. I wanted it to be the story of one family, and I wanted it to sort of be about the effects of politics or political events on this one family's life. And I didn't think, I mean, when I was working on it again, I didn't think about how it ends up being, in a way, a claustrophobic novel. You know, it's so much confined to this one house, and that wasn't a conscious choice either, but I think that's now I'm working on another novel, and again I haven't thought about it, but that's sort of how it's ending up as well. I think in those in those ways of people being sort of trapped in one environment together, and I don't know if it's more of a female way to think and to write, but
that's interesting.
One
of the things I liked about it was that it allowed like in this sort of confined world, you can kind of you kind of feel that as a reader that you know everything about it, which you couldn't get in a, if you're writing about a nation or a town or a broader space.
That's right, yeah.
You kind of feel like you know all of the causes and effects, and you can, especially because you go into so much detail about all the different characters, you know, by the end I really felt like I understood everybody's motivations and what affected them and those sort of things.
That's right, yes. Yeah, exactly, and I think also because I was working so much with the perspective of children, that was another, I think it kind of came out of that as well, that because I was, you know, children's lives are sort of confined to their home, especially when they're the age of Asha, that, you know, you pretty much have your house and your school, and I didn't really go into school that much in the book, so I think because of that, that's one of the reasons why it's so centered on the house, because it's not entirely from the point of view of the children, but a lot of it is, and you know, the children and the mother, also sort of by choice is confined to the house. So it is in that sense a domestic a domestic novel, but I think I wanted to convey I'm repeating myself a little bit, but I wanted to convey sort of how, even in that controlled domestic environment, the outside world makes itself felt, like
yeah.
that Malaysian politics are kind of, you know, pervasive enough or powerful enough that even just living your life quietly at home, it does make its presence felt.
No, I think you did that very effectively, and I thought there were. I mean, to me, I read a lot of parallels in the domestic story with the story of Malaysia as a nation. You know, in what you're talking about with the sort of the way you're not allowed to talk about certain things and
the secrets and the lies. Exactly. Yeah, the lack of honesty. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it worked well. I did like the sort of fact that it was an omniscient sort of narrator, but there were sort of definite perspectives to it.
Right.
It did feel like to me it was, you know, mostly from the children's perspective, particularly from Asha's perspective.
And one of the
biggest achievements of the book is that you can sympathise with all of the characters, even though there's so much like bad treatment of each other.
I mean, you know, I think it's interesting to hear different readers. People either felt that you could sympathize with none of them or that you could sympathize with all of them. So I suppose it depends where you're coming from or how you're reading it or what your own baggage is that you bring to the novel. But definitely, yeah, I try to give them equal treatment. So I think the end result is that either you're going to sympathize with all of them or with none of them.
Yeah. No, I guess people bring their own things to it. But I mean, to me, the amount of... Because, I mean, if you understand people's... I think when you judge people, it's often because you don't understand all of the things that are going on in their lives. And
the more information
you have, the easier it is to be compassionate.
Yeah,
and
that's very true.
You sort of, you know, I started off thinking that the mother was a horrible person, and then you kind of read more about her backstory and you understand, okay, well, that's why she's behaving like that.
Right, yeah.
So,
I
was interested in the fact that the two characters, the sort of slightly more outsiders in the big house, Chelam and Uncle Ballroom.
Yeah.
They both tell the family the truth about themselves. They both sort of get punished for telling the truth.
Yes.
Is that something that you sort of see more generally? That like the interesting thing is they also get punished with lies. You know, they get lies told about them, and the lies kind of win out over the truth. Is that because it's a dysfunctional family, or is that something you see more generally, that lies win out over truth?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, sometimes when you ask me these questions, this is the first time I'm thinking about that in those, you know, I haven't tried to summarize it for myself before, but you're quite right. I mean, that's exactly what happens. And I think, I would say that the novel... On the one hand, you know, when people ask me, well, is this representative of the condition of women in Malaysia, or some huge question like that, I think, well, you know, it's just a story about one family, and you can't claim that it represents a nation any more than, I don't know, one novel by Ian McEwan represents all of, you know, British history and culture. But on the other hand, of course, yes, it does reflect my own views about how I think Malaysian society works and what, you know, sort of the weaknesses and the way that it's the way that we our relationships with each other in Malaysia. So yeah, I do think that, and I think most Malaysians who have had some distance would agree with me. I do think that this is something that is almost a stereotype about Asian culture in general, is that there's a lot that's not said, and there are very strict rules, unwritten rules about what is okay to say and what is not okay to say, and you sort of have to know those rules either by having grown up in the culture or by having spent enough time there, but people are, I think if you stepped into the culture as a complete outsider, you would find that it was fundamentally dishonest in some ways, and that we find these we sort of cover over what's really happening with these acceptable lies. Mm. And it can be, in many cases, like, everyone knows that it's a lie, but that's how our society operates, like, that's how it functions, is that we sort of need to tell each other these lies.
Right.
So
I was also interested in the fact that you know, Chelam is accused of this very serious thing that she didn't do,
and yet
she never protests her innocence. Which sort of seems to me like that, you know, that's an instinctive thing that people would do, and I was interested in why, you know, why she doesn't.
Yeah, I think, I think, you know, Chalam isn't based on anyone that I actually know in real life, but I did. I mean, the novel, sort of the two main strands, the relationship between the sisters and then this other thing with the servant girl, and both of these things came out of, well, it had been a long, long time that I'd wanted to write a novel about servants in Malaysia. So, because I think, yeah, I mean, even though Chalam's not based on one specific person, I think this is true of servants in Malaysia when I was growing up, and now with we have a lot of sort of immigrant labor coming in from outside, Indonesian and Filipino maids, and it's still true that they are completely disenfranchised, and they just don't have, they don't see themselves even, especially the Indonesians who are working in Malaysia now, and at the time in the 1980s, the sort of Indians from the estates who were brought into wealthier houses to work, they didn't see themselves as having any rights.
Right.
So they came into these houses completely expecting that, you know, things that their lives would be miserable, and that they wouldn't that anything could be done to them basically, and they should not speak out about it. So
that to me was very powerful, that she wouldn't even, you know, that she was so silenced.
Sort of the assumption that, well, even if the assumption behind it is also, even if I did speak out, even if I myself know that what's being done to me is wrong, no one's going to believe me anyway. So, you know, I have this, you sort of have the whole weight of society against this one person who has no money and no power, so they're never going to speak out. Yeah.
No, it's that kind of weight, it's the sort of inevitability of the fact that she kind of knows that she can't fight, even if the person against her is only 6 years old. You know, her word counts for nothing. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so that was very powerful that she didn't even do anything. She just kind of retired to her room, and it was like she kind of knew what was going to happen. So, okay. Well, actually, one more question about the characters. Asher reminded me a lot of Bryony in Ian McEwan's Atonement. You know, she sort of plays a similar role. I know that's a book that you sort of list as one of your influences. Was that
But again, I had started writing. I actually started writing Evening is the Whole Day in 1999.
Oh wow!
So, it was before Atonement came out.
Yeah.
And but Atonement definitely was, again, like Waterland, one of those books that when I read it, then it spoke so much to me. And reading Atonement actually sort of made that crystallize in my head that I actually really like novels where children are put in this position of having to decide the fate of adults.
Yeah.
And there's a whole sort of subcategory in my mind of novels that do this. Atonement is one more recent one, but also another novel that I list sometimes as an influence is The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley. I don't know if do you know that one as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, but I read it a long, long time ago. But
yeah, exactly. It's one
it.
That
it's
you know everyone reads at university or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so I, you know, yeah, I read it myself at university as well, and at the time I didn't, you know, think of it as, you know, falling into this category of novels in which children do bad things or make poor decisions. But yeah, I really, something about that I find very powerful and very rich from mining in fiction. The fact that
it's a very interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. The fact that I think there's so many expressions too, even in our own, even in language. You know, out of mouths of babes. This assumption that children say things that are more honest or more true, but it's not. I mean, the truth is so much more complicated than that. I mean, children are not completely innocent or without malice or without, you know, children too have their own sort of stake in things and their own agenda. And and I think I really wanted to explore that. Yeah,
and I think that often they have a sort of different type of, you know, a completely different way of thinking of the world. And so when they come into conflict with these sort of adult things that they don't quite understand, it's very unpredictable what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, and they can do enormous harm to each other or to adults, you know. And so I wanted to, I mean, there's always, I mean, the simple way of thinking about it, I think, in popular culture is that, oh, children, they're so innocent and they need to be protected and we do so many awful things to them. But I think, you know, the reality is so much more complex, so...
Yeah, and you do. I mean, you do make Asher into a real, you know, into a real person who has a lot of. You know, you go into a lot of. You really understand her motives, which are very complicated. They're not. You know, they're not. She's not a simple 6-year-old girl just saying what
she
sees.
Right, exactly.
She's
and I think any child, you know, any child really does have a lot of power over adults, and it's something that we don't really talk about much, or we don't really think about much, because I mean, if you're a parent or if you're someone who deals with young children on a daily basis, you just sort of think about, you know, getting them through every day and kind of taking care of their basic needs, but I think in the relationship between adults and children, it's not just kind of a one way, you know, the adult having all the power and the child being powerless. I don't think it's that at all.